This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
All right, joining me now is someone I've been looking forward to doing a podcast with for a very long time. He is a five-division world champion. He is one of the most financially successful fighters in boxing history. He's a tremendous fighter, broadcaster, person, a guy I've really enjoyed getting to know over the last few years, the great Sugar Ray Leonard. Ray, how are you?
Chris, I tell you, it's good seeing you, man. I haven't seen you in quite some time, and with this new, coronavirus, it's like a movie. It seems so surreal.
No, it's surreal all around, man. It's like a new experience for everybody. Though I should point out, I mean, you are quarantined in like a city, which is what your house looks like. I mean, your house is basically a city. So my sympathy only runs so deep, Ray, I got to tell you. you know what's funny, Ray? Like a byproduct of being quarantined, I think I'm the same as a lot of people, is that you get to watch, you start watching a lot more old fights. I mean, we've seen ESPN has run a lot of old fights on the network. I've found myself on YouTube for, you know, hours on end just watching old boxing matches, and a lot of your old fights as well. Have you found that, I don't know if whether it's through social media or people talking to you, have you found that people are watching more old boxing nowadays?
I would say yes. I you know, it's just the fact that we have so much time. You know, that's when I truly appreciate, Chris. I appreciate what we have, where we are, our health and everything else, because now it's like I'm going crazy. I calmed down a little bit. But I was going crazy because I was stationary. But watching the old fights, like you said, has been quite helpful.
Yeah, it's certainly fun. And people that didn't know how incredible boxing was back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, they're getting a real glimpse at just how mainstream it was. So if people are listening and they're like, I would love to see the very best of Sugar Ray Leonard, what fight would you tell them to watch that you felt you were at your best in?
I would say Tommy Hearns, number one, back in 81. And also Marvelous Marvin Hagler back in 87, because each of those fights required the 100% out of me. It was like one of those fights where is that Muhammad Ali, who I love and was my mentor and my idol, he told me one day, he said, you know what, when I fought Joe Frazier, that was the closest thing to death. And I quite didn't understand it, but when I reviewed the fights with the Hagler or Tommy Hearns or Roberto Duran, number one, I was there. I understood what he was saying.
Yeah, Hearns, I should say, that was 1982. And I mean, that was like, I mean, that was a 6'2" welterweight. I mean, you don't see too many guys that are that height and are able to make 147 pounds. What do you remember about going into that fight? Like, did you have to come up with a completely new strategy to fight a guy that had that kind of height and reach advantage on you?
Well, I knew I had to be aggressive. I knew I had to take the fight to him, I was thinking. And I watched tapes of his fights, previous fights, over and over and over again. So I choreographed the fight in my head. And I remember, Chris, I may have not told you this, but when I first walked to the ring that night, I was walking around and saying, all right, I'm fighting Tommy Hearns now. Now, who in this audience, this crowd of people, would be the perfect style for Tommy Hearns? I walked around, didn't see anybody, and I saw Muhammad Ali. And if you go back and watch the fight, the first round, I was like Muhammad Ali, moving around, slipping. Tommy couldn't really land a big punch on me until when the bell rung, I punched. I said, gotcha, sucker. And he was so mad, I said, I gotta make him lose his composure. That was what was taking place.
Did he, I mean, he was known at that time. I mean, his biggest, his biggest power punching days were as a welterweight. That was when he had his heaviest hands. Did you, when he hit you for the first time, what was your reaction to it?
You know, my brother, my biggest, my older brother, Roger, who got me into boxing, he didn't think I could win. I paid him. But when Tommy finally hit me with one of his shots, the right hand, and I said, is that it? Because they do say styles make fights, and it's true. Certain guys can take certain punches from certain other fighters. Tommy hit me. Tommy never hurt me in that fight. The second fight, he almost destroyed me. But he hit me, and I hit him, and I rocked him. I say, I hit just as hard as he does.
Mm. When, you know, people look back on your career, and it's funny, there almost never was a Sugar Ray Leonard pro boxing career. I mean, 1976, you said after you won that gold medal that you were done. You had accomplished what you set out to accomplish. When you said that in Montreal at the time, how serious were you, and why did you feel like you didn't want to go pro?
I was 99% serious, and I nearly cried standing up there having the gold medal draped around my neck. And I was like, because I said, oh my God, this is it. Now it's over now. And there was a little part of me saying, no, just wait till you get home. But I only turned pro to help my father and my parents for financial needs, because, you know, we came up pretty humble. And I turned pro because my dad went into a coma. We had nothing, had no money. So I turned pro just for that reason. But when I did it, it was like I found boxing again. Boxing found me, and we found each other.
If your father had been, at that time, been healthy and financially secure, what would Ray Leonard have become?
You know, Chris, I'm glad you asked that question, because people laugh when I get the answer, because I want to be a substitute teacher. Don't ask me why, but because the substitute teachers I've had throughout my school years were always sweet, always nice, and always hospitable, and give me and help me out. God, I wanted to be, I tell you, that's what I wanted to be, a substitute teacher.
I can just see you in the tie and the short sleeve shirt, maybe a little belly on your Ray, a couple of extra meals.
No belly. No, take that back. Take that back.
Belly.
No belly.
So you do get, you just said it there that when, once you got back into boxing, you kind of rediscovered your love for it. Tell me about that. What got you, what re-sparked that fire?
You know, I love boxing. I still do, because what it creates for me, a sense of self, and not just because of beating people up, but just it gave me confidence to walk with my chin up. I love, Chris, the transformation when I was in training camp, that I was training for like, I don't know, 2-3 months, and I'm training. All of a sudden, you know, within a month, my body changes, my mind changes. I mean, I'm like, it's just an amazing feeling. It's hard to articulate, to try to give you a better chance to understand what I'm trying to say, but it created something in me.
Mm-hmm. And you said along the line, I read a couple of clips where you said boxing was your safe haven. No matter what was going on in your life, you could just always control what happened in boxing.
I said that because I always could control, for the most part, what was taking place in that ring. I dominated that ring for the most part. Outside the ring, I felt low self-esteem. I mean, as much as I had accomplished, I felt I wasn't up to par. And this bothered me for many, many years. And it took me into the drug scene, took me out to the alcohol scene. And I used those things. I didn't drink just a sip of drink or be sociable. I drank to get drunk. And I did drugs to cushion out life. I'm a lucky man. I'm a blessed man, no question about it, because I've done this for 50 years, man.
Mm. When did, you know, all those things that you were going through, when did you feel like you turned a corner? When did things get better?
I married my wife, Bernadette. I have incredible kids, although I wasn't the best father because, you know, I was in training all the time. I was traveling around the world all the time, and I was busy all the time. But you know what? There's still room for improvement. there's room for improvement.
Yeah, with all of us for sure. The most people that know you associate you with Duran, and as I was preparing to talk to you, I went back and watched the 30 for 30, which was excellent with you and Roberto Duran. And, you know, I want to go back just for a minute to, you know, 1980, you were coming off that win over Benitez. You had been a world champion and, you know, you were out there looking for that kind of, I'm assuming that kind of star making type of fight, that big fight. What was it about Duran that made you run towards that fight? At the time, he was, you know, the fighter of the 70s to some people. Like, he was this terror, hands of stone, all that. What was it about that fight that appealed to you?
You know, Chris, I knew Duran was bigger than life. I mean, Duran was a boxing champion. When I was coming up, I was watching him because he was just an amazing guy. He was a beast. And I had no say in who I'm fighting next. They'll say, Ray, you know, Duran's next. I said, yeah. But I also felt that because I was bigger, I was welterweight, 147, and he was lightweight, 135, that I could, he wouldn't be a contest. I've never been hurt so much in my career. Duran, they call him manos de piedras, hands of stone, and I felt like his rocks, his fists felt like rocks. I remember him so well. I can go back in time and smell his breath during that first fight. He was a beast.
In the build up to that fight, I mean, he was nasty. Like, he would look at you with disdain in his eyes. What do you remember about the build up to it?
Well, you're right. The disdain. I mean, he looked at me like I was like scum. And again, throughout our boxing career, I say, hey, how you doing, man? We hug each other. The minute we signed that contract, you son of a bitch. You know, and he just, there were certain resentments. And I understand some from some fighters because they called me like I was a corporate boxer, that I was a white collar boxer, that I was trying to speak white, whatever that meant, that I didn't come up the hard way. I did come up the hard way. I just won the Olympics, which was a platform.
Did you take that stuff personally, the things that Duran might have said?
Yes, I did. I took it to heart, which I learned not to do at some point later on down my career. I learned that that was about the mind, the body.
What are some of the things he said that got to you? Was it just like the whole, you know, white collar boxer, not a real fighter? I mean, what kind of stuff?
He gave me the finger. He said, you might have gone. I'm still working on what that means, but I know it's bad. He cursed me. Then he cursed my wife. And because I couldn't communicate, I couldn't speak Spanish, I was so angry. I was so, so angry, Chris, that I said, you know what, I'm gonna beat this son of a bitch at his own game. So it stuck in my head to fight him toe-to-toe, which was not the healthiest thing to do.
Yeah, in a way then, he almost won the mental battle before, right? Because you did. You, those first couple of rounds, you were far more flat-footed than we've ever seen you. You were trying to trade with him, which is, you know, the way he wanted that fight to go, right?
He picked me right. He said the right things at the right time. And it got to me. He got under my skin. And again, I didn't know any other way to communicate to him but beat him at his own game, toe-to-toe. And I tell you, he hit me so hard so many times in so many other places that I looked at him and I said, you know what? This is it. I contemplated in the ring my last fight. I really thought about, that's how much pain and punching power this guy had. He was a perpetual motion.
How would you describe that power? Because some guys have that kind of speed power. Other guys have just those, that concussive right hand.
Hurt power. When he hit me, it hurt. He was the only guy, and I fought a lot. Now, you know, I fought a lot of guys. He was the only guy that really, when he hit me to the body, I was like, well, okay, man, okay. Because he was just, he punched with such conviction. He punched with hatred in his heart and his mind. And once he gets you hurt, he'll take you out of there.
Mm. What was your?
But I,
What is your corner telling you in those moments? Like, your corner's got to be seeing you fighting a way that you hadn't fought before. Were you guys on the same page going into that fight?
You know, we were. Because, again, the fight plan was to box him. I mean, I had the speed. I had the reach, the height. I had everything. I just didn't use it. And so when I got back to the corner, they were more concerned, was I okay? And I blocked it out, Chris. I blocked it out, whatever they said to me. I didn't hear a damn thing. All I heard was to myself, I got to get him back. The next round. Maybe the next round. Maybe the next round.
Mm. What was it that something triggered in you at some point in those later rounds where you went from, it looked like he was in control, and then you get to like 11 on and you just flipped a switch of some kind? Was there a conscious moment there for you where you said, all right, this is, I've got to flurry now. I've got to find a way to beat this guy.
I knew, and fighters know, we know when we're losing. I mean, it's not hard. Because you feel it. You know you're being taken, you know the guy's landing more punches than you, combinations than you. I knew that. I knew it was close, put it that way. I'd say the fight is close because I will flurry sometimes. But again, he's one of the few guys besides Wilfred Benitez that I missed so many punches. I threw so many punches that I actually almost punched myself out. But I had so much heart. And I didn't want to lose my championship belt that I fought him so hard, like in the closing round, 13, 14, and 15.
Hmm. Yeah, you see a lot of trash talk, Ray, when, you know, in the build up to fights. Oftentimes after fights, you know, guys are real friendly. They shake hands, they hug, they embrace, respect, as you know, you're out there risking your life. Not so much with Duran after that first fight. Like, he was still yelling at you from across the ring. He's screaming at you even after he won the decision.
I know. No, he. I don't think he liked me a lot. Maybe a little bit, but not a lot. But you're right. He was, again, he was so, that was like brutality, man. He was resentment.
You seemed almost surprised by it. Like, watching the video of the fight, you almost seemed surprised that he was still saying nasty things to you after the fight was over.
That's a good question. I'm glad you asked that question because I didn't understand. I was saying, damn, he's taking this thing further. I mean, it's personal. This stuff is personal. I remember that. I swear, I remember it so well because he was yelling and cursing me and the motions and the hand gestures and things. Yeah, I said, damn, this guy has a problem.
Mm-hmm. So you finish a fight like that, a war, you go on vacation, and at what point do you decide, I got to do this again, and what brought you there?
I took my wife after the fight to Hawaii just to get away from everything and everybody. And that image of me, of Duran raising his hands as the new champ, I went away. I want to take my wife away because she fainted. Actually, she fainted at ringside. Hell, I almost fainted. But I remember on the beach running, and some of the fans said, "Hey, Sugar, hey man, you could have won that fight if you fought your own fight." And I heard this every day. So I called my trainer, who was my business partner, my friend, my lawyer. I want to fight Duran as soon as possible. He said, "Ray, I thought you were on vacation." I said, "I am." He said, "Well, son," he said, "enjoy your vacation." And we talked. I said, "No, I'm coming home tomorrow." And that's exactly what happened because I wanted to fight Duran as soon as possible. Because I had something in my heart and in my mind that says, do it now. Because I also knew Duran's style that he hung out. I mean, I hung out too. But he had tough times making weight. He gained so much weight prior to each fight.
Mm. So, yeah, talk to me about that, because taking a fight like that, taking a rematch so quickly, you never see that nowadays. Like, nowadays, there's at least one interim fight, if not two, as we saw, like, with Fury and Wilder at the top of the heavyweight division. Was taking the rematch, was it as much about him and trying to take advantage of his lifestyle and his, you know, likelihood that he's going to blow up as it was you wanting it?
It was both. It was both of those things. It was the fact that I knew that he hung out and partied quite a bit, like I did. But he gained so much weight, and I said, I want it as soon as possible, ASAP. Because if I gain weight, I gain maybe five pounds. And also my entourage was at one time during that fight, the first fight, was like 40 people in my camp. They were bothering me because they said, Ray, can I use the car? Can I do this? I said, guys, I'm in a training camp. I'm here to fight Durant. And when I stopped that or cut that in half, the fight was much, much better.
What was the biggest your entourage ever got?
It was 40 people. 40 people, yeah.
What were they all doing?
There are a couple of guys, like guys like Juice or JD and my brothers, Kenny and Roger. Naturally, my trainers, they all was focused. I call it tunnel vision. They were all focused with tunnel vision. The other guys were just hanging out, going to parties, needing transportation. I mean, what the hell am I thinking about transportation?
all thinking they're on the payroll?
They were. Got a little per diem.
On the payroll. It's a nice life. You can get it working on Ray's payroll. When you started going to, you know, in the fight week stuff, when they had press conferences, did you notice anything different in Duran?
Well, because this time I stayed stone face, but control, not anger. I look professional. I was extremely confident. And, you know, though each press conference, they were getting better and better because I felt more relaxed and more relaxed. And then I started controlling the atmosphere. One thing that took place in that ring that night of the second fight, Ray Charles, my namesake, sang America the Beautiful. And if you go back and watch it, my face just, I lit up. And that was the first time I met Ray Charles, who I'm named after. The first time of all the places in the world, in the one of the most critical and most important fights of my life. Oh, I was ready. I was ready, Chris.
Yeah, and I remember seeing that visual, and you were concentrating as all fighters do in that moment, but then you just broke your entire character and then went right over to Ray and hugged him. a big smile on your face.
And I said, hey, he hugged me. He gave me a little kiss and says, kick his ass. I said, yes, I will.
You were playing some mental games with Duran before then too. There was the whole beard stuff. I mean, you would roll into press conferences, you know, with a full beard on for that fight.
It was fake. It was a fake beard, but it got under his skin a little bit. It just made him mad. He laughed. I don't know. I tried everything to kind of get an edge. And it was the beard thing. I felt extremely stupid with the beard. I mean, because that's not me, but I did it. I try to get every edge. I just try to get a little bit edge here, a little bit there. And it adds up.
And you came out, Ray. I mean, that was a different version of the guy we saw in the first fight. You were bouncing. You were moving. You looked like the guy we'd seen up until that first fight.
Absolutely. That's the first fight. I walked in there and I was like, I did something like this with my hands. I'm like, okay. But the second fight, I was so focused, ready, a little loose because I was smiling, but got serious again. I was ready. I was so ready for that fight. And during the early rounds, when things were, he couldn't touch me. And then I did something like this, and I did this. All those things were not planned. Though they happened so extemporaneously. They happened so instantly. And then people were laughing. And I heard them laughing. And the more I did, the louder it got. And then I looked at his face, and he was puzzled. He didn't know what the hell was going on. And it bothered him. It really, really bothered him. And I kept doing it.
Could you notice, I mean, you're in there with him. You'd felt everything he had for 15 rounds the first time. When you started exchanging with him, was he different, you know, than the first fight?
He was different, yeah. You know, you'll notice me, I was never really a stationary target, even against the ropes or even in the corner. if I'm there, I'll be there after a couple punches and I'll slip out. I'll go left or right. I use my footwork.
Yeah, and it was incredibly effective all throughout. And, you know, it's funny, Ray, you could just say, if you say the words to anybody that's been a sports fan ever on the street, the words "No Mas," everybody knows what that means. Like everybody, even if you're not a boxing fan, you connect it to that fight and that moment. And that's been, it's been talked about and dug into so much over the years, including in that great documentary. But can you just tell me, in that moment, what did you see? What did you hear? How did you experience that like 10-second stretch where he just gave up?
When it just happened so like quick, it was such, because I stuck my chin out and did that. I did bolo punch, pop. And when he did this, I didn't hear him say, in all due respect to Roberto, I never heard him say "no mas," but I feel this is, you know, what that means. What does that indicate? He never said "no mas" to me, but he told the referee, no more.
You know, you said that, going back to the last fight, you said that fighters know when they're behind. I would imagine that fighters also know when they're hurting their opponent, when they're getting to him. Did you feel like going into that eighth round that something like that was even possible, that you were beating him down in that way?
No, that was so bizarre because, I mean, of all people, Roberto Duran, that never even came up in my mind. It was my brother Roger who yelled, "Ray, he's quitting. But no, I never thought that would happen. That's Disneyland.
You know, it went from like a moment of complete joy for you to the aftermath. I mean, it must have been frustrating to hear every question be about Duran, where it's like, did he quit? Why did he quit? What was that like for you?
Now, that's another good question, Chris, because that was the topic. That was like the topic of this press conference. And like, all we were talking about was, why did Duran quit? Or how did he quit? Or so, not, I said, hey, I did this. I made him quit. I was really upset. I got really, really mad because I wasn't given credit for what I did to this incredible champion fighter and Roberto Duran. No matter what I do, but I wasn't given credit. It was an excuse that he claimed was his stomach or his cramps or something like that.
Oh, he's claimed
a lot. But you know, Chris, I love Roberto. We're friends now, and I give him all the respect in the world. But what happened that particular night was from what I did. Mm.
Yeah. How long did that bother you? Because that was the story, not just the night of the fight, but in the days and weeks that followed, magazine stories. It was all "no mas." It was all about that, and not Sugar Ray Leonard wins his title back. You know, back on top at welterweight.
For years. And I mean, I remember that moment. I mean, in as much as I was happy that I won the fight, I won my title back, it was disturbing to me that it wasn't because of what I did. It was him. He was the topic. He was like, Roberto Duran, mysteriously or bizarre, quit. No mas. I mean, it did bother me.
It was funny watching the end of that 30 for 30. I think Duran asked you something like, you know, why didn't I get the third fight right away? And you were basically like, because I didn't want to give it to you. Because I can do whatever I want. And I didn't want to give it to you.
No, I was being a jerk. I was being like sarcastic, narcissistic. But it was true. I was in a good position that I could kind of call the shots.
Was that brought to you at any point in like the months that followed? Like, let's do this a third time.
No, it was talked about, but our concern was that people say they set that up. And it was. So I've heard some people say, "Yeah, that fight was rigged," and that hurts my heart when someone say it's fake. It's not real. Mm. That was really real.
I mean, people are stupid, Ray. I mean, first, like, we're now in, like, currently, we're hearing how Canelo didn't really knock out Kovalev when he blasted him in the face and, you know, put him down last November. People just, conspiracy theories run amok, you know, especially in boxing. Some of them are true. I mean, boxing's a shady business sometimes, as you know better than anybody. But now that was, you'd have to, it's a real stretch to think that fight was a fix.
And you know what, going to Panama, I was very apprehensive about going there because I said, these people, they're going to kill me. But it was just the opposite. I got there and the fans were there and they hugged me, we took pictures and everything. And I went to Roberto's, doesn't he have a bar or something? He had a restaurant or something like that, I think. And I went there. It was just so weird. It was so weird being there with Roberto Duran, who I used to hate and I despise. I mean, he wasn't one of my friends until after our career ended.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Time heals all wounds. Sometimes with things like that, where you forget about how nasty things were, you know, back in the day, and get into it. After the Duran fight, I mean, you started to roll along. You beat Tommy Hearns. You're on top of the welterweight division. And then 1982, you call it quits. I mean, you had the eye injury, right. But how much of it was the eye injury, and how much of it was you just didn't want to box anymore?
No, I wanted to fight again. I cherish my support from my fans and my family, and they all said, Ray, you know, you have the money, you have the fame, you have this, you have that. But it was more than just that. I love to win. I love the competition. And it kept me off the streets, put it that way. It was hard. It was really hard, Chris. It was really, really hard saying no. But I said, I want people to think of me as being kind of somewhat of a rational guy, a smart guy who knew when to quit. And I proved that.
leaving all that money on the table, was that difficult? I mean, you obviously had made a lot of money, and I'm sure you were, as you are still, very good with your money. You had left behind some big fights, some big money. I mean, what was that part of it like?
I tell you, and it may sound kooky, but at a certain point in my career after the Tommy Hearns fight, it wasn't about the money. Although, you know, it's from a business perspective, you want the best, but that didn't make me tick. That didn't make me train hard, you know? Because like now, it's all relative. You know, they're making, back in the day when there was making money, Ali was making like $5 million, I think it was, or $2.5 million. And then I came along, I was making 10 or whatever. And then Tyson, then Oscar De La Hoya, Mayweather. I mean, just a time. I mean, it's another generation, another legacy.
So what happens between 82 and 84 when you decide to come back against Kevin Howard? I mean, Howard was, you know, at least Howard was supposed to just kind of be the build up to Hagler, right? It was like, I fight Howard, I look good, I fight Marvin Hagler. What changed in you between 82 and like the end of 83 that made you want back in?
No, the Howard fight was, there was no indication that I would fight Hagler. There was no indication.
Oh.
There was talk about it, brief conversations, but never Kevin Howard first, then Marvin. He was the ideal opponent to come back because he was never really in shape. He didn't have that much power, we thought. But I got into that ring and it just wasn't there. And he hit me, he hurt me. But not bad, but he hurt me. That was weird. I mean, that was one of those moments where it's that sometimes we say, God, I wish I had not accepted this fight. Because the first punch he threw was like a jab, boom. And I said, man, that hurt. He hurt me. I mean, the knockdown didn't bother me at all. Mm-hmm. I was okay.
What was it then that brought you you back? I mean, if you're retired, you've got the money. I mean, what was it that brought you back into the sport?
I saw the Hagler fight in Vegas, John Beast Mugabe. I watched that fight. I'm sitting at, you know, at ringside with some friends. And I said, hey, man, I could beat Hagler. Let's see, Ray, Ray. Okay. I said, give me another vodka tonic. I was drinking heavily then. Because I was really sad. I was really depressed because I just didn't have it. And I called Mike Trainer, my buddy, my business partner. I said, Mike, I can beat Hagler. He said, Ray, are you drinking? I said, that has nothing to do with it. I said, beat Hagler. He said, Ray, just get home. We'll talk about it. I got home and I said, I can fight. He said, Ray, and I had so many drinks, man, that night. And but I thought I saw something in him. And I announced, people thought I was crazy. They thought I was crazy. Everybody thought I was crazy. Rightfully so, because at that time, I was losing my stability of trusting myself anymore, from alcohol to drugs. I was out there, Chris, big time. I was really out there. Mm-hmm. Thank God for that fight.
So you fight the Howard fight, and afterwards you just say, like, I don't have it anymore? Like, what's your thinking right after?
I said, you know what? I don't have it. I'm going to admit the fact this is my last fight. And I, you know, and so when I said I want to fight Hagler, they said, why would you go from a kind of a fighter like Kevin Howard then to a beast like Marvelous Marvin Hagler? I said, because I need to be afraid. I need to be scared. And it is true. When you challenge me and I know what you can do, yeah, I train harder. I be more focused. Yeah. Mm.
I think the, you know, Hagler, if I'm not mistaken, was at the Kevin Howard fight. The fight was in Worcester,
yes,
in Massachusetts. I remember somebody interviewed Hagler afterwards and said and passed on what you had said, like, I'm done, I'm retired. And Hagler just basically being, well, fuck my life. Well, that, you know, this is just another blow to me. Like, I can't get that damn big fight, and it's all Ray Leonard's fault. Probably Ray one of like 10 times in those next couple of years he was pissed off at you.
I understood his feelings. It wasn't purposely. I didn't do that intentionally. Just happened. And I knew I shouldn't go in the ring against Hagler. I didn't think people would be that sincere about, he's going to kill you. I mean, even my brothers, they say, man, he said, when is your tune-up fight? Who's your tune-up fight? I said, Hagler. He said, I know you're fighting Hagler, but who's your tune-up fight? I said, Hagler. They didn't understand that because I was afraid of losing, especially guys like the caliber of Tommy Hearns and Marvin Hagler. And I would have the right mindset. I trained my butt off for a year. I actually trained for like a year and a half, on and off, to kind of get to unshock the body, because your body gets sharp when it's coming from a 2 or 3 year layoff.
What happens then, Ray, between like 84 and 87, when you retire after Kevin Howard, and you know after the Howard fight, you're like, all right, I'm done, I can't do it. What triggers you to want to not only come back, but to come back against the guy that after the Howard fight, you felt like you couldn't fight, like you couldn't beat him?
Yeah, it's a weird thing. That's a very interesting question, because I cannot explain what goes through this mind of mine, because when I feel I can win, not 50%, no, 100%, I feel it, I know it. And although there's opposition, and rightfully so, people have a right to speak their mind, and they thought, the biggest obstacle I had to overcome was, they say, Ray, if you get hurt in boxing, you're going to hurt boxing. So that means I'm selfish. I wasn't thinking about getting hurt. I had no intention of getting hurt. And wow, man, that's, when I go back there, I think about how blessed I am to have gone through all those moments and to still be able to talk to you.
No, and in between, Ray, like in between your fight with Howard and when you took on Hagler, I mean, Hagler was dominating. Like he put Tommy Hearns down. Like that was the round of the year, round of the decade, whatever you want to call it, in the first round. Then he just detonated Tommy Hearns. I mean, he was, I mean, when you watched him fight Hearns, did you, I mean, how did that make you feel? How did you react to that?
I was there, right? I was calling the fight. So I'm sitting there with HBO, and I had in my head contemplated coming back. It was thoughts on my mind. I didn't say anything, but I'm watching that fight. I said, no freaking way. I'm good. I'm okay. I said, I'm okay. I'm okay now. And I didn't give it a second thought.
and he, but like after that, I mean, are you, does that make you, that makes you not want to fight him anymore?
Well, it was evident. I mean, they both were just throwing bombs. Mm. It was also another fight. When Duran fought Hagler, I was at ringside broadcast. And after the fight, 15 rounds, Duran walks over towards me and says, "You box him, you beat him." He said those exact words. And I said, maybe he's right. But that night we hung out. So after, you know, a couple shots of tequila, whatever I had, I was talking trash. So it's interesting how these things come about.
Hmm. So what was the difference then between the Ray Leonard that fought Kevin Howard and the Ray Leonard that fought Marvin Hagler 3 years later?
I wanted to win. I mean, against Kevin Howard, I want to win, but he was not a stature that would create, I feed off the crowd. I feed off the audience. I feed off the ones that says he's going to get knocked out. He's going to get beaten so bad. I love that. That's what gets me going. That's what kicks in that the additional round. And because most people thought I would get killed, and rightfully so, I said, I'm gonna prove them wrong. So I had this attitude. Yeah, I had this attitude going to that ring.
So it worked. When you got in there with him, what did you notice right away? I mean, you can't know somebody till you get in the ring with them. What did you feel? What did you notice about how he was going to fight you right away?
I'm looking at him and I'm saying, you know what? Because the look on his face, I said, you know what? He's just as nervous as I am. So all of a sudden we walk in the ring and then we're walking towards each other like this. And I'm saying, okay, now I can't walk away. And I'm gonna walk straight into him. And all of a sudden we just both sheared off like that together. I mean, because that's just a head game. That's just a head game. Instead of walking towards each other. But the bell rung and I'm nervous. I'm extremely nervous because I don't know what I have in the gym is not what you need in that ring. So I did that there, and I said, "Pop!" I hit with the. I said, "This shit still works." That's what it does. I said, "It still works." And the first couple rounds, he says, "Fighting like a man, you little bitch! Fighting like a man." I said, "No, no, no! But take this." Pow! I remember this so vividly, Chris. I remember every single round. And when he hit me one time, I think it was in the fifth round, fourth round, he rocked me. He didn't hurt me. He rocked me. He knocked me back. And that's when he threw his punches. But Hagler is just heavy-handed, though. He's really heavy-handed. Just, it's like a heavyweight. Mm.
You'd said that that you know when you're losing. Hagler will, I'm sure, as you will take to his grave, the fact that he won that fight. He believes he won that fight. How did you feel after it was over, when that final bell rang? How confident were you that you had won?
I felt close. I said, it's just close. It depends on how you score the fight. What I was telling my my guy, Ollie Dunlap. I said, because Ollie has a big, deep voice. I said, Ollie, yell 30 seconds before the bell rings. Because I will shoe shot. I will throw a number of punches. So that way, that's what the judges remember last.
Mm-hmm. The that was Hagler's last fight. So was there talk of a rematch of doing that again? I mean, what did that conversation look like?
That was, and it bothered me a little bit that they were saying the opposite. They were saying, "Well, you know, you didn't give him a rematch." That's not true. He didn't want a rematch. Hagler was one of the few fighters, champions, who can walk away with no bearing, no hatred or whatever. He just walked away from the ring. But I mean, he deserved the rematch. And I would have given him that rematch. They never asked for it. And then they never replied.
Sorry, say that last part again, Ray. You say never won. I didn't, my cell phone, my internet.
Yeah. No, I was saying the fact that they said, well, Ray didn't give Hagler a rematch. That's not true. I gave him off the rematch. I don't want the rematch. He deserved a rematch. And it's just the fact that he went away. He went away to, I think it was it Milan, Italy? I think he lived.
Hagler's a different cat, man. Like I see him every so often, rarely at Celtics games, and he just rolls in with his, you know, probably $4,000 suit on, and he sits courtside, and he just seems content and not at all worried about the past.
Yeah, I like Mom. Mom is a good guy. He's a great champion, incredible champion, middleweight. You know, he gets his dues. And people are always giving him his props. He's that kind of a fighter. I've never seen Hagler enter that ring not being in shape. He's always dominated.
There was, when we were talking during the buildup for Canelo versus Kovalev, one of the subjects that came up a lot was your decision to jump and fight a light heavyweight for the light heavyweight championship. And I remember, you know, a lot of things you say stick with me, but one of them was, you know, you said you remember being in the ring with Lalonde and just feeling that first punch and immediately being like, oh, no, I don't want to do this again. Like, I'm going to get through this, but I don't want to do this again.
When I fought Lalonde, and they said, well, he has one. He's not a great fighter. Well, you know what? He's a big fighter, and he hurt me. I've never been hurt so many times in 12 rounds. I mean, well, it didn't go 12 rounds. But he hurt me. He hit me and hurt me so bad, especially inside with those little uppercuts. I mean, Chris, he was hurting me bad. I mean, he was hurting me. I was on the brink of almost like being knocked out. I was that close. But the knockdown, I was not hurt. He hit me, caught me kind of on the temple. So my equilibrium was knocked off. But I composed myself. In fact, if you go back and watch the fight, I backed up towards the ropes, and he's coming at me. And I kept going to his body. And if you watch the shots to the body, those were the damaging shots that I threw upon him.
Mm. And I mean, I don't know. Did you even expect that from him? Because he was a champion, but it wasn't like he was this, you know, celebrated champion. This was kind of a chance for you to get that title at 175 against a guy that I'm sure going in, you thought you were a pretty good favorite against.
Well, what it was, okay, we both were fighting for the 168, the super middleweight title. He was willing to put his title on the line. His belt is 175 by heavyweight champ, for additional cash, which he got. But they all thought rightfully so, because I mean the guy's a big guy. His people just felt that he would just be too much for me. But because I felt that the atmosphere, you know, the hoopla and everything else would be too much for his head. He handled that well. What he did wrong was that he was trying to get me out of there. He was throwing so many punches, and every time he did that, I was able to get close and hit him in the body.
Mm. Oh man, I remember you saying to me that I think you said something like, as soon as that fight was over, I was vacating that 175 title.
I did tell you that. I relinquished that crown right same night. You know, I had it for less than 24 hours. those guys, I mean, yeah, I'm fast and all this kind of stuff, but fighting a big man, if that big man hit you, he's going to hurt you.
Mm. What was the best atmosphere that you were ever a part of? The crowd, the event. I mean, you were part of so many. When you look back on all of them, I mean, what was the one that stands out?
Wow. The Tommy Hearns, the Roberto Duran. That was, I mean, when you in those stadiums, it's night and day. Well, at Caesar's Palace was like one of the best. It's like Madison Square Garden. You fight Madison Square Garden, you're it. And they told me the same thing until I fought Camacho. Did you forget that one?
Yeah, I'll get to there for it in a second. You know, it's funny. When I was just going back and looking at some of your fights, like, I think you said the Caesar's Palace one, the Hearns, one of them was on a Wednesday, wasn't it? Like, these were, like, now we're so used to Saturday fights. You were fighting, like, midweek sometimes.
Yeah, I don't remember. But I'm sure that was the case, yes.
Yeah, you're doing some midweek stuff. The end of your career, whatever, like the Norris stuff and then fighting Camacho, do you have any regrets looking back at it now? Would you do anything differently if you could go back and do it all again?
From a business perspective, it was really kind of almost like hard to turn down. From an overall standpoint, no. But then again, I am who I am, Chris, because of those, not just wins, but losses. And the way they were lost, I hold no regrets whatsoever. You know, and as I'm saying this to you, I'm saying, like, how can I not say that it was wrong to do that? No, I am who I am because of what I've been through.
Mm. What was it that brought you back for Camacho? I remember, you know, you were ringside for Camacho Duran, I think, and he kind of heckled you a little bit. Did that have anything to do with it?
No, we were friends. No, you know what? I just felt better in the ring. I felt safer in the ring. And at that point that you were talking and referring to, that date and that time and that person, I was going through some tough times with my life, alcohol and drugs and stuff. I was in the ring, I could control it. Outside of the ring, I couldn't control it. I do now because I have things to live for. You know, I have family, an incredible family. I have my foundation. Life is what you make it. I heard that a long time ago. I didn't understand. I didn't say life is indeed what you make it. I don't want to be known for, you know, a guy who lost his money, a guy who went to jail because of drugs and that. I didn't want my parents to see that anymore. And one of my friends who's no longer with me or with us, James Anderson, who was my security guy, he said, "Ray, you know, because he was the one who got me sober and made me go to fix myself." He said, "Ray, forget about yourself. Think about your kids. Think about your family." And I did.
It's funny. We talked at the start of this about how, you know, if your father had been healthier and in better financial shape, maybe you wouldn't have turned pro and been a substitute teacher. If you had a more stable personal life, if you didn't get caught up in some of the things that you're talking about, the drugs and alcohol, is it possible you might never have come back from some of these retirements and just stayed retired and enjoy your life? Because it sounds like what you're saying is boxing was what you could control. Like that was where it was functional. And when you weren't boxing, it was not functional.
But you know, and that's interesting you say it that way. But it was meant to be. If I worked hard, and I pray like I do. I pray all the time, and not to win, but to no one get hurt. But my life and my career, my legacy was meant to be that way. You with me? It was meant to be.
Absolutely. Now that it's all over, and you talked about how you're friends with Duran and all these other guys.
I spoke to Tommy a couple of days ago.
So what? Tell me what is your relationship like with the other four kings, with Duran, with Hagler, with Tommy?
I don't see Roberto Duran that often. It's only when, you know, when there's an event, something of that nature. Tommy, we talk, we communicate, we correspond. And he said, Ray, you know, Ray, you beat me and I beat you, and you admitted that second fight. He said, we have one more fight left. I said, Tommy, are you talking about me hitting you and you hitting me? I said, Tommy, when was the last time you looked at your driver's license and what age you are? I said, Tommy, no one's gonna hit my face ever, ever again, except my wife.
When was Tommy's last fight? Wasn't it like 2010? Like, didn't he stick around for?
Who did he fight? I don't even know who he fought.
I'd have to look it up, but he stuck around longer than you, I think. He stuck around. I'm looking it up as we're recording this right now, and his last fight was, all right, 2006. He won against a guy named Shannon Landberg, who was 58-10. He fought in Detroit, so he stuck around for a while.
Really? Well, you know what? We get through it somehow, some way, and if you're healthy, God bless.
And what about Hagler? Where are you and Hagler right now?
We're still working on that. he doesn't call me on my birthday, neither do I. But I love Marvin. Marvin, he may not believe this, but I do love him. I respect him. And I consider him one of the greatest fighters, middleweight champions ever. And I just hope we can get together and do some things. I try to propose a tour with us, me, the four of us, a movie. I think about things that we can do now before we leave this earth, things that we can show, things that we thought about, things. I mean, there has been, I think there's a couple of documentaries out on us, but I want to do it our way.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, let the fans hear, you know, what was I feeling? What was Hagler feeling? What was Tommy feeling? Why did Roberto Duran, you know, what was his feelings? You with me? The four of us together now? I mean, because normally these great fighters, legend, they pass away before they're recognized or acknowledged.
If you look, I say that because we have joked about that in the past, like how you know, Hearns is on board, Duran's on board, Hagler, not so much. Hagler, you can't, still not picking up that phone call when he sees Leonard on the caller ID to get there.
Yeah, I'm going to use your phone next time, okay?
it'll be a burner phone to call Marvin Hagler. But you could, I mean, if you guys ever got together, you could like sell out an arena just to hear you guys talk. Like, I'd moderate that for free. Like, that would be, I mean, how much fun would that be? Just the four of you guys talking about the 1980s and fights. You could do 3 hours and everybody would still want more on that. I agree with you completely.
Well, Chris, the proposal is sent to you now.
I'm going to call. Maybe, look, Ray, I'm from Boston. Maybe Marvin will pick up, you know, my 617 area code. You know, he grew up right down the street from me. So, I mean, it's
this. Did he really?
He did a few towns over.
Wow.
He did. So wow. I'll see if I can broker that for a percentage of the gate. I'll broker that for a view. two quick like current questions for you. You mentioned a couple of times Mike Trainer, your lawyer and advisor. You did something that very few fighters today choose to do. You went out your own way. You didn't tie yourself to a major promoter that often. You had your guy and you had him make fights. Why did you choose to do that, and why did you feel like that was good for you?
No, it was Mike Trainer who said that. He said, Ray, you know, how much do you believe that you can become world champion? I said, 100%. He said, so that being said, you can promote yourself. You could be an independent contractor. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. I mean, I'm a kid from the street. And but everything I have, everything I've captured, with endorsements and things of that nature, is Mike Trainer and also Jenks Morton, who was my mentor, who I had good people around me. I mean, my publicist, Charlie Brotman. I mean, I can go on and on and on. Karen Kinder, he used to call them secretaries back then. But I had, you know what, Chris? I also, again, I keep saying I was blessed. I had good people around me, solid people, you know? And life is a challenge for all of us. I just tell people, man, just never give up. Just don't give up.
Mm-hmm. No,
but have the right people with you.
There's so few fighters, Ray, that do it that way. I mean, recently, Miguel Cotto kind of did, you know, once he split from Top Rank, he was his own man. He bounced back and forth between promoters. He signed short deals, and he got big fights. Didn't win them all, but he got big fights, and that really defined his legacy. I mean, you did it at a high level. Miguel did it at a high level. I just wonder why boxers don't take that route more often.
It's not just that easy, unfortunately. You got to have a name. It has to be a platform. If you think about it, my platform was the Olympics. I mean, and TV and things, I was on television, network television, free television, constantly. So I had marketability, you know, because of all that stuff. But you know what? I'm so happy for so many of the young fighters who are showing their talent, who are fighting. And they, you know, they say, I'm the best. And I say, if you're the best, you got to fight the best. And they're starting to do that now. Boxing's dead. Boxing's not dead. And boxing will always be around. I just wish all those young fighters, incredible young fighters who are so talented, the best of luck. And keep your humility. Because you can lose it. It's so easy to lose. You know, I lost mine for a while. But, and give back, reciprocate, help other people or other causes.
Well, I remember, what was it? Errol Spence said he sent you a copy of sent him like a DVD of his fights and sent it to your office. And he said he never heard back from you.
No.
You remember that? He said that a while. And I think you said afterwards, like, I didn't get it. Like, I didn't
see it. I responded to him. Mm. I mean, that I didn't get that. All right, Errol. Send it to me again. All right. Now I'm on camera now. Right?
Yes. You're on camera. You'll now work with Errol. Have you ever wanted to be a trainer?
I don't have the mentality to be a trainer. I can show you what it takes to win. Strategy, tactics, and that kind of thing. I think it takes a special person to be a trainer, to be a good trainer, to be a great trainer. It takes a special person.
Yeah, we don't.
I don't have it, you know. Because if you don't give me 100%, I lose interest. Especially if you have talent. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know we were talking about this recently because Floyd Mayweather says he wants to be a trainer, and I have my doubts that. You know, because fighters on his level, on your level, you just don't see them become, you know, the great trainers, in part probably because of what you said there. Like, if you're not going to give it what I gave it, I don't have the patience for you. And I'm sure in part, like, it's just hard to show something that you're just so great at. Like, if you show somebody something, I bet you almost want them to be able to do it. It must be frustrating that they can't.
Yeah, you know, with Mayweather, incredible champion. And it's natural. You're born with it. You can't give someone speed. Accuracy, I don't know. But speed, no, speed is a natural thing. Even the power of Mike Tyson, you can't show a person, show a fighter how to have power like Mike Tyson. Mike was born that way. He's born with power. You can show how to gain more leverage. Yeah. But not that crazy power, not that knockout power like Tommy Hearns, Roberto Duran, yeah.
Is there anyone that you wish you had fought during your career? I asked you about regrets and you said you don't have any, but a fight that you wished happened and that didn't happen?
No, I mean, I answered it quickly because there's nothing. I mean, I'm totally satisfied. You know, I was in an era where is that, we had the Tommy Hearns and Durans, Wolf Benitez, and who doesn't get the credit he deserves, I guess because he didn't beat any of us. But Wilfred Benitez was an amazing champion. But no.
And you mentioned the platform that you had. That 76 Olympic team, that was stacked. Like, people in this generation think of Olympic boxing as, well, you know, it's no stars come from it. Maybe you get Shakur Stevenson every so often. But that 76 team, man, you guys were good.
That was one of the greatest, if not the greatest, moments in my life, experiences in my life, being behind that those majestic doors and gates. We were, my God, I remember that so well, and it meant so much to me. And thank God my parents were alive, and they sat there and watched me win the gold medal in Montreal. 1976, that's a long time. How many years is that?
Oh, God. We're dating both of ourselves now, Ray. Like 40 years ago at this point.
40 years?
40-plus years.
40. You know, they say time is fleeting. Time is fast. Goes by fast. I never thought about that until I hit 50. Now it goes by even faster. But I love it. I love it. And I accept it.
Were you guys close on that 76 team?
We were. Yeah, you know, they God, I mean, that had the biggest impact on me, being behind those majestic gates, being with my friends, fighting the best guys in the world, and competing on a stage that the world sees. And that's where it all began. That's where it all started. And I remember being on the podium, and they put my gold medal around my neck, and I'm saying, this is it, this is it. Oh, man, no more boxing. I remember feeling so happy, but feeling so sad that my career was going to end. It was wild. It was really wild. And the fact that I still remember that, it comes to my mind every now and then. Especially when they talk about the Olympics, I'm like, oh my God.
It's kind of sad what happened to the U.S. boxing program. I mean, yeah, you know, that really was, you know, from you to all the way up to Oscar De La Hoya, like, it really was a star-making platform.
Oh, without question. I mean, that was the stage that you want to be on. Especially, you know, when back in the day, it was fighting in the Olympics on network television. Wow. I mean, it was a perfect stage.
So it'll be you and Tommy Hearns, May 2021. We can have the WBC create a fake title, you know, the senior citizens title of the world. You're in? You're ready to go?
Chris, you said fake title.
All right, want a real title? I don't know.
Well, no. I said, Tommy, you're not going to hit me. I said, Tommy, all body shots. He said, okay, all body shots. You want to promote this?
I want in. I'm ready. And you can bring Marvin, and Marvin takes on the winner, and you can just have like a round robin for a couple of years. You know, you're
okay. It sounds more even. It sounds even more interesting now. More intriguing now. It's just the way you say it.
I'm a salesman, Ray. I'm just trying to get this fight off the ground. Get Hearns versus Leonard 3, the rubber match.
Can we use some of your contacts?
Absolutely. I mean, I'll call Marvin right now to get him. You know, he and I are close. We're best friends. So,
Chris, you're on camera.
I can lie on camera. It's okay. I do it for a living. I do it for a living. Hey, Ray, it's really been a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to catch up with you. It's great working with you, great being around you. I'm glad to see you're doing so well. And stay healthy out there, man. I know you're probably going to go for like a lap swim in one of your three pools, but, you know, maybe you can invite me over when this settles down. Four pools. Okay, sorry. Did I get it wrong?
Thanks, Chris. Love you, baby.